This is an ABC podcast.
There are a lot of people who I suspect are represented very heavily in this room who think honesty is about facts and adhering to them. But there are other people who say, well, actually, that is a source of honesty. But there are different sorts of honesty. And authenticity and being true to what you believe is a form of honesty as well. And it means you can have different views about which dimension of honesty is the important one at any time.
Honesty and truth have long been regarded as the cornerstone of civilization. But we now talk about living in a post-truth era, where fake news, deception and lies are the common tools of communication. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. This is Big Ideas on Radio National and online. While lies seem to be more tolerated these days than in the past, they've been with us from the beginning, when human communication evolved. In fact, you can ask whether communication has evolved to pass on facts or lies. Are we only honest by coincidence? As Professor of Psychology Richard Byrne explains, even animals deceive.
Okay, imagine you're a monkey. Now, as a monkey, you probably live in a group. Most monkeys live in groups in order to have safety from predators by various mechanisms, dilution of risk, spotting the enemy before they get to you, and so forth. Which is fine. It's essential for survival. On the other hand, living in a group brings difficulties because the other monkeys are of your species. They are your worst possible competitors. They all happen to have the same diet as you, for instance. If you're a male, all the other males would like to mate with the same females. If you're a female, you would be competing again for the resources for your offspring against all those other females. It's very bad news. How are you going to improve your chances as an individual monkey living in a group? Well, there's one obvious way of doing so, and that is brute force, fighting. That's fine if you happen to be the strongest and you know it, but what about everybody else? What about the ones who would simply lose fights? Clearly, it's not a good strategy for everybody. But alternatively, perhaps there's a subtle way of competing by using deception, fake news, as we tend to call it nowadays, misrepresenting your intentions, hiding and concealing your body or your ideas, misleading signalling. Here's an example of deception in primates. Two gorillas. There's a rather fine, handsome silverback male and a female, in fact, the highest ranked female in this small gorilla group. But that male may be a very nice chap, but he is not the leading male of the group. He has no real right to mate with her. Nevertheless, what she's doing, standing at 90 degrees to him and flagging her head from side to side, is soliciting him to engage in a sexual relation. The result of that was presumably what she was trying to achieve. The two animals stayed behind as the group drifted away until they were out of sight and out of hearing of the rest. But on this occasion, perhaps not out of mind, because the silverback male was in fact suspicious as to where these two individuals had gone and prowled back to investigate, with the result that they were caught in the act. What happens in cases like this, if she's caught secretly mating with the wrong male, it's she who will get beaten up. And she was chased around by the silverback on this occasion. Now, this is a behaviour that we call tactical deception. And the boring formal definition is worth mentioning. Acts from the normal repertoire, deployed such that another individual is likely to misinterpret what the acts signify to the advantage of the agent, leaving it open as to whether the agent, the deceiver, actually understands that or just simply does it. But the effect only works to the agent's advantage if somebody misunderstands. Deception, of course, is fairly familiar in biology, but it's usually what you might call strategic deception, where an animal or even a plant is committed to some deceptive form or deceptive behaviour fashioned by evolution. And examples of that, which are very familiar from, you know, biology 101, might be, for example, this pile of leaves. And if you look closely, one of them's actually a moth, not a leaf at all. Moths do tend to try and look like bits of dead bark or trees, and here's one that's been placed or landed on a surface where its camouflage doesn't work very well. If it's threatened by a predator, it flicks open its wings, just automatically. And that looks like two rather fierce eyes in a red background, which might give the moth that little chance to escape because the predator would be disconcerted. Another example is the way that in displays of chimpanzees, probably something you've often seen on nature programs, the hair is erected. This ability to piloerect makes the animal, if it does it, look very much bigger. Well, it might be that it's a bluff, that it's resembling an animal that's much bigger and more muscular than it really is. But the problem with bluffs is they get called. And in an important matter like dominance in a group of chimpanzees, which has implications for mating success, I would suggest it's very unlikely that it functions by bluff. But there's an alternative. It's very hard to see what's underneath that long hair. So it may function simply by ambiguity, concealing what's really there, making it risky for a potential challenger, unless he has some private information as to the strength of the individual. So it may be a good strategy by withholding information, being economical with the truth, we'd probably say in human terms. Here's a few examples to go back to tactical deception, deceptions which are deployed to manipulate others. Here's a case in baboons. Baboons I was studying at the time in southern Africa. One baboon was being chased by an aggressive and higher-ranked male. I was never aware of what he'd done wrong, but he was certainly in trouble. What happened, though, was not that he got caught. Suddenly, he jumped up and gave an alarm call and looked round, as if he'd seen something alarming, which for these groups of baboons might have been another troop or might have been a predator. Well, I had high-quality binoculars, and as far as I could see, there wasn't any. And indeed, the higher-rank aggressive baboon seemed to come to that conclusion after a few minutes of staring round in puzzlement, by which time he'd forgotten to attack the individual he was chasing. Fake news? It can work. Another example from the same group of baboons was a young baboon who came across an older adult who had found some very high quality food. There wasn't very much food at that time of year. This was in a mountain area at a cold, dry, wintry period when there was very low qualities of food around. But this female had found some good stuff. The youngster stared and nothing much happened. And then suddenly the youngster screamed as if it had been attacked. Well, I was there, it hadn't been. It was misrepresenting the situation. But his mother was some way away, and she came charging in. She hadn't been able to see what I had, that there had been no threat to her precious youngster. And she came charging in and chased the other adult, who was lower rank to her, although much larger and more formidable than the little baboon. Well, you might think if the baboon had genuinely been frightened, it would have been sitting there recovering its shock. Not a bit of it. He went straight in and started eating the food from the hole, revealing somewhat that his plan was not related to fear, but food. Here's an example that came from the work of a Swiss primatologist, Kummer. He studied these baboons over many years, a different species of baboon that lives in little harems, rather like mountain gorillas do. The leading male of this harem, the target of the deception, would be very possessive of any of his females. And what Cromwell noticed was a particular female spent about 20 minutes wriggling her bottom over a distance of, I think he said, less than 2 meters. She wriggled and wriggled. His attention as an observer was drawn to that because he couldn't at first see why she was doing it. But gradually it became clear because she was wriggling in such a way that she could groom a presumably handsome and attractive young male who she should not have been consorting with. She was visible to her harem leader male. She was not out of sight, but her hands were out of sight, as was the youngster who she was not supposed to be grooming. So as far as the researcher could see, what she had done was to position herself in a way to selectively conceal the incriminating aspects of the behaviour she wanted to engage in. Those are a few examples. There are a lot of other cases. They follow what you might call a few simple rules. Firstly, the deceptions are aimed at specific targets. The fake scream will only work if the target is lower rank than the mother. It's not something that a young baboon can go off and do all the time and profit from it. It has to be rather specifically targeted. The circumstances have to be specific too. So, for example, the fake scream really only works if your mother can't see what's going on. It wouldn't work if she was there. It's no good choosing your target when you haven't taken account of the position of your protector. Deceptions like this have to be deployed at low frequency, as the famous children's story about the boy who cried wolf makes clear. And in the case of that fake predator example, it would apply very much so. If that individual spent his time simulating predators every time he got into any sort of difficulty, individuals would soon habituate and start to ignore him. And in all these cases, because the targets are members of the same group, they're individuals who are always around. So deception has to be pretty subtle and undetected to be any use. If it's detected, the individual's likely to be punished for what it's got away with anyway. Compare that to the strategic deception of the automatic flicking out of the wings of that eyed hawk moth, where it only has to work once to save the individual's life. It's never going to meet the same predator again, as long as it survived that one incident. It's a very different sort of deception. To achieve tactical deception, as these various monkeys do, you certainly need good perception, because you've got to be able to identify individual monkeys because of those rules that I mentioned. You have to know who you're deploying deception against. And we have independent evidence that monkeys do recognize others as different individuals. You must have to have what you could call good imagination, the ability to somewhat imagine the 3D geometry of the situation. Think of that female Hamadryas baboon who is grooming an individual behind a rock. She has to understand something about how it looks from another position. Monkeys must have a good memory too, to store the knowledge of other monkeys. For example, their ranks, who their friends are or their kin, and any particular interactions they've had. And again, we have evidence that monkeys have these abilities. And because these are rather one-off kinds of trickery, they're not ones that every individual of the group has ever shown, we believe that they are learned from past experience. So they must be very good at learning, because the sort of experience that gives you the ability to trick others like that is a relatively rare occurrence. It's not something that happens every day. For example, consider the young baboon who screamed when he hadn't been hurt. He might have learnt, provided on a past occasion his mother had been nearby but not close, and he had really tried to grab food from a bigger and more dangerous individual who had really threatened him. And then, because he got a windfall benefit, he might have started doing it again. But that sort of thing doesn't happen every day, even for monkeys who spend a lot of time foraging. So good learning ability is likely. But notice that what I'm not suggesting is that these individuals have necessarily any understanding of the false beliefs that they are actually causing in others, not any need for deliberate planning in advance. That may seem puzzling, but there was no real evidence of understanding or planning to deceive in monkeys. All of the cases could be accounted for by rapid learning from plausible, if unusual, past circumstances. And there was no evidence of planning tactics to counter being deceived. So there was no evidence in the targets that they envisaged that somebody might be planning to deceive them. The situation is different in great apes. Great apes, that's chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, orangutans. In their deceptions, we did find evidence. Some cases were incredibly hard to dismiss as just learning. They really looked more like planning. There were cases of countering deception that looked as if individuals envisaged the possibility of trickery. There has been recent experimental evidence of great apes understanding false beliefs in experimental situations. So it is somewhat different in apes to monkeys. But to take a broader view, I think it's fair to say that the deception versus the honesty is really a matter of coincidence. That's not what animals are trying to achieve. So, yes, deception's all over the place. There's strategic deception that we all learn about in our O-grade biology. There's tactical deception of the kind that I've illustrated in monkeys. And in apes, at least, there is sometimes intentional deception, where individuals plan to deceive others. But what about animal communication? Surely the word communication suggests honesty. Well, not really, because natural selection favours selfish manipulation of others, not altruistically giving away information. And animal communication is normally now seen as beneficial to the communicator, and the truth value of the information is coincidental. That's what I meant by honest by coincidence. Signals are true only when it pays the signaller, not for any particular virtue in truth. And even in cases where they do happen to be true, and we might label them honest, it's probably misleading to use that human term, honesty, because it implies that the animals want others to be honest. The honesty seems to be just as coincidental. It's not really the point. There's no social custom of honesty and truthfulness. So why, you might say, are we so keen on truth? Well, most of us. Suppose, and this is purely speculation, so probably easy to knock down, but in mulling it over, one possibility occurred as to how it might have evolved. Suppose that human ancestors relied on cooperation even more than chimpanzees do. We know that chimpanzees can be very cooperative, but perhaps human ancestors relied on cooperation more. And I think most paleoanthropologists would say, yeah, sure. Suppose also that at some stage in our ancestry, individuals were apart from others, even more than chimpanzees are. Chimpanzees fragment into subgroups and regroup, but a lot of the time they're near other chimpanzees. With larger ranges, perhaps human ancestors were out of each other's way more. That produces a problem, because if you don't know what individuals are doing when you can't check them out, as a monkey can living in a cohesive group, then it's very important to know who you can trust, but you have less opportunity to do so. So it would be important, but difficult, to be sure of the trustworthiness of others in your social group. That, I would suggest, would favour major sanctions for lying or deceit, if it's caught. Not just because you get away with something, but because of getting away with it by being dishonest. With major sanctions, then people human ancestors perhaps, should then be more trustworthy. Provided they're in the group. That is the group of individuals who socialise together, what you might call a mutual, I've called here a mutual help group, but a small society of individuals who know, on the whole, can trust, have major sanctions against any violations of trust. And in that circumstance, you can trust everybody. The trouble is we now live in much larger societies, nations, nation states, even wider than that, thanks to the news media and the internet and so forth. And it's perhaps that's why the evolutionary legacy of living in small, trustworthy groups with major sanctions for any violations, we're now rather naturally gullible. And of course, there are no real sanctions for people outside our own immediate social group who get away with lying.
Broadcast, podcast, or on the ABC Listen app. You're with Paul Barclay on Radio National. And this is Big Ideas, the home of the finest talks from Australia and around the world.
You'll hear now from economist and broadcaster Evan Davis about why people lie and why different forms of lying, from near lies to self-deception, are so widespread in today's public discourse. As Evan Davis says, it's all a variation of what he defines as bullshit. And a warning, you'll hear that word a lot in this talk.
The first thing to say when we come to human societies is that we do have, particularly in public discourse in the West, have a history and a tradition of quite marked sanctions against direct lying. We can argue about whether that's changed in the last couple of years. But direct lying is something that politicians are very keen not to do. The broader panoply of deceptive and manipulative techniques in communication, which I call bullshit, you know, they can get away with that, and so they do. And so, by the way, do we all. So what do I mean by bullshit? Because I think this takes us into the sort of realm of what happens in public discourse, what are the things we do. So there is lying, which is a sort of subset of bullshit. There's near lying. The famous Bill Clinton, I didn't have sexual relations with that woman. Bill Clinton's defense was that wasn't a lie. She had had them with him when you looked at the particular definitions he was using. He hadn't had them with her. That was a kind of going up to a line and not quite going over. So the near lie is one. Then you've got a whole gamut of things of like economy with the truth, which is just not saying stuff that would leave the wrong impression. Obfuscation, which is very, very common in political discourse, which is just saying something that is irrelevant to the point that you're making that gives the wrong impression. And the most interesting piece of bullshit, form of bullshit, which was written about and studied by an American philosopher called Harry Frankfurt, first in the 1980s, in a seminal work called On Bullshit, which was the start of bullshit studies as a serious piece of discipline. Harry Frankfurt said, what defines bullshit for him is what he called disregard for facts. Now, disregard for facts is different for lying. Disregard for facts is the pub bore who's kind of making up stories. He's not really trying to deceive you to get you to believe the story. He's trying to big up himself to some extent. It's not about the facts. He would like the facts to be true as he says them. The facts are probably easily verifiable if he wanted to make an effort and go and find them, but nevertheless, he says them. It is disregard for facts that is, I think, one of the most striking features of Donald Trump. Donald Trump, in fact, could have been invented to illustrate Harry Frankfurt's paper on bullshit, written first in the 1980s, because a lot of what Donald Trump says that people are calling lies are so easily verifiably falsified that you have to say something else must be going on when he says them. He doesn't say, I had the biggest electoral college win since Ronald Reagan, in order to persuade you he has the biggest electoral college win since Ronald Reagan, because we can look that up on Wikipedia and see his isn't the biggest since President Obama. And so it is something funny and different is going on. So bullshit is a whole complex of things and disregard for facts should be separated out in our minds from lying. Because deceptive techniques and deceptive behavior comes in a complex pattern of different forms, it is possible for American voters at the time of the 2016 election, in the exit poll, the CNN exit poll, it is possible for almost the same number of them to say that they think Donald Trump is trustworthy as Hillary Clinton. Because one of the interesting features about that election and politics and everything that's going on since is that there are a lot of people who I suspect are represented very heavily in this room who think honesty is about facts and adhering to them. But there are other people who say, well, actually, that is a source of honesty, but there are different sorts of honesty. And authenticity and being true to what you believe is a form of honesty as well. And when the Americans came to look at the two candidates in that election, interestingly, a lot of them, I think, found Donald Trump more honest. Because although they knew he was talking crap a lot of the time, they also knew that they could tell he was when he was. So it wasn't kind of threatening lies. And Hillary Clinton often came across, this is my surmise, as inauthentic. And you didn't know what she believed or what she didn't believe, because she often had focus group tested her messaging to make sure it sounded right in the right group. And it's like, oh, I don't know whether she believes that or whether she's saying it because some professional messenger has coached her in how to say it properly. Donald Trump, you never really felt that he'd been through that professional guidance. And it was very refreshing for a lot of voters. And it felt, in many respects, more honest, not less honest, even though he disregarded the facts on an industrial scale. So that's my sort of opening point. Bullshit, complicated, varied, and it means you can have different views about which dimension of honesty is the important one at any time. And a lot of American voters, I think, found Donald Trump's dishonesty, his form of bullshit, refreshingly different to the old-style political establishment's form of bullshit, and they also found solace in some other things which I'm going to come to. Now, I first got into this whole area, so that's my sort of introductory point. It's all about bullshit and different forms. I got into this area actually as an economist, because economists really are fascinated in dishonesty. They think it gets in the way of markets functioning properly. You want to sell me your second-hand car. I want to buy a second-hand car. I don't think I can trust anything you say about the quality of the car that you are trying to sell me. So I pay a discount for the car. I will only give less for the car than it's worth if it's a good car, because I just don't know whether it's a good car, and I have no means of verifying whether it's a good car, and I'm certainly not going to believe you when you say it's a good car, because you would say that anyway. Now, that insight about the second-hand car market won an economist a Nobel Prize. And that is no joke, and it turns out to be a really, really powerful insight. And economists ever since have been absolutely obsessed by information dysfunctions in markets. But economists, who are kind of embedded in the mindset of evolutionary biology and psychology, economists make very simple assumptions about human beings. They say, we're all basically rational, because we've sort of evolved to be rational. We've all evolved to be rational. If I'm buying a second-hand car from you, I will never, ever believe what you tell me about it, because you would say it's good anyway. I would be dim. I would be stupid to trust you. This is the basic economic model. I would be stupid to trust you. I'm not stupid, because we're all rational. And thereby, you will never even bother wasting your breath lying to me. Because why would you do that if I'm not going to believe you? And that is, I know that sounds weird, but that actually is at the sort of the fundamental underpinning of a lot of economic thinking on this. And it is a kind of evolutionarily derived rule of thumb, that it wouldn't be evolutionarily stable if I was to believe you when you try and sell me the second-hand car. Darwin is going to sort of write me out of the script over a few kind of millennia if I'm stupid enough to believe you. And so let's just assume that we're all rational. And in the world of the rational people, no one believes anything they shouldn't believe, and thus no one wastes their breath trying to persuade us of things that no one believes. Now, like a number of other areas of economic thinking and economic theory, there is some, I think, discrepancy between what we observe about a world devoid of lies, deception, and bullshit, and the world we observe. So I think the really fascinating thing to ask yourself, is why is there so much bullshit in public discourse and in private discourse, when as rational, reasonably rational beings, you would think there wouldn't be very much? And I'm going to offer you two answers here, which I think both explain a lot of what we see. So answer number one, why is there so much of this rubbish, is that we're not rational human beings. So that's the first one. And what we find is we have evolved with all sorts of rules of thumb cast into our brains. We have a tendency to cut corners all over the place. If you haven't read Daniel Kahneman's book, Fast Thinking, Slow Thinking, you really should. It's just a book that clarifies, I think, so much about how we think. But he basically says we have two ways of thinking, the instinctive way and the cognitive conscious way. The instinctive way is what you're doing when you walk home on a route you're familiar with. You don't have to think about, do I turn left here? And you just do it, basically. Driving on a motorway, picking up a phone, calling your other half, all those things, instinctive brain. And then we have our cognitive brain, which is when we apply our thinking. When you're navigating on a map to find your way home because you don't know which way you're going, should I turn left here? And the essential point is that the instinctive brain is much the bigger and more active part of our brain, and it's full of shortcuts and foibles and whims and little things. And the cognitive brain is not really that big a part of the way we are. And the instinctive brain can be manipulated and have all sorts of mistakes made. And so a lot of the time, what is going on in politics is an appeal to our instinctive brains, away from our cognitive brains, and it's trying to manipulate our beliefs in gentle-ish ways, usually, manipulate our beliefs to accord with the beliefs of the deceiver. Now, I can give you examples from out of politics. Okay, so my book was originally £20, but a lot of items you will find are priced at something 99 or something 95. That is a form of bullshit. That's trying to make you think the book is sort of cheaper than it is, right? Or the car, or the clothes, or the milk, or whatever it is. Psychological pricing, it's called. That is a really good example of trying to appeal to our system one brain, our instinctive brain. We see that price, and somehow it looks a bit lower than the round number above it. So that's a really good example of kind of appealing to the whims. Or laughter tracks on comedy programs, where you actually apply the laughter to the comedy program. It does make the program a little bit funnier. That's why they do it. And that's what's that doing? That's appealing to a kind of, well, there's literature on actually what it is and why we laugh when other people laugh and things like that. But there's no doubt there's a kind of bandwagon effect that if one laughs, it makes it easier for other people to laugh. And we tend to assume what we're watching is funnier if everyone around us is laughing. And then we tend to join in. There's a social aspect to laughter. So these are examples. These are examples of the way in which our instinctive brain can be appealed to. It's not all about rationality. The John Lewis Christmas ad is going to come out, an event I look forward to every year in which I will cry, probably for the first 4 or 5 viewings of that ad. What is that? That's appealing to an emotional reaction. Again, it's not irrational, it's an instinctive emotional reaction. It's bullshit, doesn't really tell me very much about John Lewis, but it's going to appeal to me. Now, I think when we come to this, you have to be very careful. Although we're not rational, and you've all accepted that, and I accept that, and we think the economists are stupid to think we're all rational. Of course, that's just a stupid rule of thumb or a simplifying rule of thumb. The truth is, I think you have to be very careful at thinking people are dim. Because I don't think people have evolved to get this far by being stupid. And sometimes, I mean, there are a lot of stupid people, don't get me wrong, let's be quite clear. I mean, a lot, lots and lots. And there was a lovely quote, think about how stupid the average person is, and remember that half the population is stupider than that, is that? I am not going to deny that there are stupid people. Absolutely not. However, should you assume people are stupid? That should you assume that because we have these whims and because our rational brain is a small portion of ourselves, that we are somehow hapless fools ready to be manipulated at all times? One of my points, my key takeaway point tonight is we're not rational, but we're also not stupid. And when I watch that John Lewis ad and cry, I am a willing accomplice to that ad because I really like John Lewis already. I can think of organizations, shops, political parties or other things who, if they tried to run an ad like that, I wouldn't feel, oh, I cry, isn't that lovely? I would think that is manipulative rubbish, I hate it. It would have exactly the opposite. And that's because although I am a human being with an irrational brain, I'm also a human being who is capable of overriding the irrational brain from time to time when I need to. Or similarly this, it is true that a coffee may be priced at, you know, $2.95, which may sound comfortable compared to $3. So I might be inclined to buy it at $2.95 and not at $3. When it comes to buying a house, I don't think it makes that much difference because I am not going to buy the house by being fooled by the price, because I'm going to think very hard about buying a house. So I will engage my System 2 brain, even though most of my decisions about coffee or this or that, everyday things, are made instinctively. So my first set of sort of explanations around why the economist's model doesn't persist or doesn't work are around the fact that we are not rational. But I want to posit the suggestion that the rationality assumption is actually not bad for anything that is really very important. That people go through complicated sequences or difficult challenges or things that they really need to address, and then it's not as easy just to say we're subject to manipulation. I mean, I'm not saying we're not subject to manipulation, and there are people who are victims of manipulation and who are gullible. But I'm just saying, as an approximation to where the human race is, I wouldn't assume it. And too many people, I think, have a mental model that goes something like this. Boris Johnson says 350 million. Stupid public think it's 350 million. Stupid public vote for Brexit. That kind of chain of causation is one basically most of my friends believe. And I think you need to be very careful about assuming that middle bit of the chain. Boris Johnson said 350 million. People did vote as though they believed the 350 million. But you need to be very careful about assuming that they just haplessly believe everything they're told. They may be willing accomplices to the lie in the way that I am a willing accomplice to the John Lewis ad. So it's quite possible. Or you have to ask yourself this. Something funny is going on there, because the public were told two things about the cost of the EU. It's 350 million, and it's not 350 million. And that was repeated fairly extensively. I know people say we didn't give enough attention to it. It was repeated that it's not 350 million. Then you have to ask yourself, why do people confronted with two propositions choose to believe one of them? That's if they did believe one of them. Maybe they didn't even know what 350 million was, because to be quite honest, most people don't really think very much about the billions in there. They don't know whether it's 110 billion or 350 million. These numbers are actually not things that most people are having to work in every day. So be very careful in assuming people are not sensible, even if we're not a rational human being. So that's the first sort of set my discussion of the first explanation as to why there's so much rubbish. Let me give you a second explanation as to why there's so much bullshit in public discourse and the purpose it serves. I go to dinner at yours. You serve a lovely first course. We enjoy nice conversation, bottle of wine, blah, 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 nice dinner party. Then you're going to get a kind of gooseberry pie that you've made out the oven for the dessert. It's burnt. Not massively burnt, it's sort of edible, but it's really not really that nice. What do I say to you about the pie? I will say, oh, it looks lovely. Thank you so much. No, don't worry about that little bit of crust. No, I'll have it. No, it looks delicious. It's bullshit. The pie's burnt, obviously. Here's the interesting thing. You know that. I know that. You know that I know that, and I know that you know that I know that. So no information about the quality of the pie has been exchanged between us. Literally none. But does that mean no information has passed between us? No. You've learned something about me. I'm well brought up. I know how to behave at a dinner party. I care for your feelings. These are non-negligible. These are non-negligible, you know, pieces of information. The bullshit that I have chosen to deploy is informative about the kind of person that I am. Interestingly, it's really subtle. The rules of communication are very subtle. If it was the case that I was your best friend and we hung out together all the time, I would say it's burnt as hell. Just go and throw it away and let's get something. And that would actually be telling you, really subtly, that would actually be telling you I'm really close to you because I don't have to engage in the funny thing where we pretend the food is good in order to show what sort of person I am. I'm showing how close to you I am by being direct about it. So bullshit has a purpose in showing things. The stories, true or false, that politicians choose to tell are communicating something about the kind of person the politician is and the kind of person they're trying to appeal to. In essence, when Trump says unemployment is 40%, he did say this in 2016. He said, I don't believe these experts, 5% they said is. No, I've heard 30%, 40%. He said, I've heard 30%, 40%. It's not 40%. But when he says that, he can be communicating a whole lot of things about whose side he's on and whose side he isn't on. The American worker, disregarded. He's not on the side of the experts who compile statistics in offices in Washington. He is communicating a lot through the bullshit. And it is because politicians communicate through bullshit that it persists, because there's a sort of honesty to it, or there's an information value to it, not an honesty, but an information value to it that people, recipients of that information, find useful. And I want to finish with the one point, the one area where I think there's something going on between where Richard's talk is and mine goes, which is the information that you really get from a politician and the stuff they spew out, and the information that the public actually want, by the way, they don't want to know how much is being spent in real terms on the health service this year compared to last year. They don't want to know all the detail about policy. What they want to know is one piece of information, maybe two. Whose side are each of these people on? Are they on my side or are they on someone else's side? And bullshit is a very good discriminator in that regard. So a lot of what you're seeing is about politicians trying to signal the people they're appealing to. And of course, what Hillary did was try to appeal very broadly, by the way, which meant that she fell flat on certain of the kind of portions of the population for whom Trump was saying, I really, really am on your side and I'm not going to hide it, or I'm not going to try to appeal to the other lot. I totally am your person. So I think that is a lot of what is going on. I think where this gets you to is that tribalism and division, which is where the US is crazily going, where we are much more than I can remember it in my lifetime, tribalism begets bullshit. And bullshit begets tribalism. Because the bullshit is about trying to say, I'm on your side and not on their side. So it kind of enhances the sense of us, them, inside a group, outside a group, two sides. Bullshit fuels that. And tribalism begets bullshit, because if you're in the tribe, you will believe the bullshit that your tribe spews. And that is the one area, I have to say, where I think we stop engaging when it's important. We stop engaging our sort of thoughtful, cognitive, system two, rational brain. It becomes just a matter of badge of honor, membership of a tribe, membership of a group. Essentially, it's all part of a tribalizing of political discourse. And Trump does it. Trump totally throws things into public conversation purely in order to work up one group and set them against another. So tribalism is enhanced by bullshit, and the bullshit is enhanced by tribalism. Just as football crowds, by the way, two opposing teams, two opposing crowds, someone falls in the box. Did he dive? Was he fouled? The two crowds will take a very different view of the same, essentially same piece of data. And that's just the game. The tribalism and bullshit are, I think, the areas where politics, primates, really begin to link up. And so I will just end with my thought, which is what I say to my friends who think the world's going to hell in a handcart, Britain's, it's all a big mess, and public discourse has collapsed into post-truth infamy. I say, if you want to reduce bullshit in public discourse, and you don't like where it's gone in the last couple of years, because I think there has been an increase, you have to reduce the tribalism. You have to make the other side feel better about themselves, feel you have respect for them and you're listening to them. And the more you do that, and the more self-critical you are about your own case, the more they will trust you and offer them to be more self-critical about their case. Obviously, if you call them a dimwit because they believed all the rubbish they were told by Boris Johnson, then instead of yielding to your view, this is my tactical advice to Remainers, instead of yielding to your view, they're going to dig in and double down on their view. And I think that's where we've got. And it's very difficult when societies are very tribal, utterly divided. It's incredibly difficult for one side to say, hey, look, we'll be nice to the other lot and show respect, because they think it may not be reciprocated by the other side. And I think that's where we are. So we're locked into a kind of a mini phase of degraded public discourse with more bullshit than there should be. Not because we're irrational or stupid, but because there's a lot of tribalism and a lot of signalling about which tribe is which and whose side we're all on. Thank you very much indeed.
So I like the idea that this is only a mini phase, Evan. Do you think that there is a chance that we're going to revert back to truthful politics?
Well, I mean, a mini phase could last anything from 2 months to 30 years. So politics is never going to be truthful, because politicians are selling, and anybody selling is going to be putting a positive gloss on what they're saying. So that's always going to be there, but I think it has become particularly dysfunctional. But I think going back to the kind of days when politicians merely said, I won't put up taxes, and we all disregarded it because we thought they probably would put up taxes, would be a refreshing. I think I'm an optimist by nature, and I think some of these divisions will heal. But we're talking years, not months, aren't we?
Richard, I wanted to ask you, can you ever use the term lying when you're talking about non-humans, do you think?
Well, I think to use it properly, you have to have some evidence that the animals have an ability to understand the mental states of others. Because to be guilty of lying, you have to understand what you're doing. Nobody imagines that the moth that flicks open its wings understands that it is momentarily creating the impression that there's something big and fierce down here. It just does it. I mean, obviously, as a psychologist interested in the evolution of human abilities, I'm really interested in which animals are capable of deceiving or understanding things in an intentional way. That's why I'm very interested in the evidence that great apes can. And I suppose you could then say, yes, you could say that chimpanzees and gorillas may be deliberately lying.
But, sorry, Richard, is there a distinction between what they do within their own group and to other groups? Are they allowed to be more horrible and lying to the other people outside?
To other groups, they're simply aggressive, or they flee.
Do you think that there is something about the amount of information that is available to us these days that has caused politics just to go far more to engage the instinctive brain? Just because there's just so much information, people are almost like, I actually can't be bothered to look into this.
I guess I think that because we have the choice of so many different streams of information, it may be that people are unintentionally always choosing streams that they find rewarding. I mean, I'm old and out of date. I suspect there are hundreds more streams on the internet and the social media that I'm not even aware of, Twitter feeds and people who might be followed, that give out what I'd probably call grossly misleading information. But if I had a different mindset, I would say, oh, yeah, great, more evidence for what I truly believe in. And I wonder if we are all rather packaged into what streams of information we're selecting. You know, when I was a kid, you could, yes, there was BBC and ITV, and there was a range of newspapers, and everyone understood that some of them were more right-wing, some of them were more left-wing. It was all rather simple. But now there's an almost unlimited number of streams. So in that sense, I think the answer is yes.
I think the answer is to some extent yes, Rachel, because I think the more information there is, and there is a hell of a lot of information around, I mean, we can zone out of it, by the way, that is an option for all of us, but for people who are enticed into processing the information available, particularly on social media, you need rules of thumb for making sense of it. And if you don't have much information, you can really pay attention to it. If it's just coming thick and fast, you need really sharp rules of thumb that are going to process it. And most of the rules of thumb that have been devised on social media for processing information by users, I surmise, please tell me I'm wrong, is does this come from someone on my side or come from someone on the other side? Which is why, by the way, I always say, again, I say to my friends, it's true that a lot of bullshit comes out of this, you know, your opponent's mouths. But you don't have to worry about that because you never really believed Boris Johnson on Brexit anyway. You're immune to Boris Johnson on Brexit. You have to worry about the friendly fire, the bullshit that's been posted on your thing. And your rule of thumb is it's from my mate or my like-minded, you know, soulmate. And therefore, I will believe it and like it and then and share it. And that's really the sort of the worrying thing about the echo chambers. The rule of thumb we're using is I believe it if it supports my worldview. And that's a really bad way of deciding on stuff. Because we know that there's confirmation bias. And we didn't talk about self-deception. A lot of the time, we believe it. It's not that we're lying or that they're lying. We've all just convinced ourselves of this stuff. And that means it's even more powerful. But ancient rivalries, Capulets and Montagues, to come back to Romeo and Juliet, ancient rivalries and persistence of them is where you don't want to go.
Rachel Wheely, following up with some questions on truth and lying. You heard from Richard Byrne and Evan Davis. That recording was from the Royal Institution of Great Britain. You can find a link to their science podcast channel on our website. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.